Hello and welcome to this month's Centre for Brexit Studies podcast on global Britain and foreign policy. I'm joined today by one of my colleagues, visiting professor and managing director in Grant Thornton's Chicago advisory team, Professor Stephen Bridges. Hello, Stephen, and welcome to the podcast.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
How are you this morning?
I'm good. Beautiful Birmingham.
So, if I may, I'd like to start with a few questions as we discuss Britain's and the EU's relationship with the United States. Since Winston Churchill spoke of the special relationship between Britain and America during the Second World War, the two nations have worked hard to support each other through several conflicts and high levels of cooperation in terms of economic activity, trades, military planning and sharing of intelligence. My question to you is, with President Trump now responsible for America's interests, can we expect to see this kind of unparalleled cooperation between the two countries continuing?
I think I'd question whether it's been as strong and consistently strong from Churchill's days all the way through. Yes, there were high points during the Bush-Blair relationship. I'm not sure if we analysed how the President Obama regime and administration looked at the UK that we would say that was the sort of the zenith of the special relationship. I think it was pretty clear that the Obama regime saw Germany as the preeminent, certainly the economy in Europe. But on a more personal level with the special relationship, I think it's seen as much more of a crutch in the UK than it is in the US. I very, very rarely hear the term special relationship in the US. We were at a conference this week here in Birmingham, the Transatlantic Trade Conference between the various chapters of the British American Business Council, and it was noticeable for me that the coining of the expression special relationship was used probably 5, 6, 7 times by British presenters, but I don't think one American presenter used it. So, you know, if the question was, is there still a special relationship with Donald Trump as president? I would say yes and no. Yes, certainly there is unrivaled cooperation, collaboration, and spirit of that special relationship in intelligence sharing, which you referenced. I think in defense cooperation. Very few people in the UK realise how many serving British military are actually in the US, and there are very few states in the United States where there isn't at least some form of UK presence, be it Air Force, Navy, Marines, Special Forces or Army. I spent a long time in the Midwest, and there at Fort Leavenworth there was something like 50, 60 Brits. So intelligence, security, defence, yes, it's a very special relationship. When you get then into that broader trade and economic relationship, it's very strong. Britain is the largest foreign investor in the US. The US is the largest foreign investor in the UK. Over 1 million Americans work for British companies in the States, and something like 1.5 million Brits work for American companies. So there's a strong economic relationship. But if you look at the US's focus on Europe, I would say, again, Germany is preeminent in terms of the partnership in economics. So it's a special relationship in key areas, but I think we're deluding ourselves a little bit if we think that it's a special relationship across every facet of our ties.
Yes. Okay, so we're recording this at the start of June, just to put listeners in the picture, and it was reported by The Guardian just last week that Trump has decided to impose tariffs on steel and aluminium producers from the EU, Canada and Mexico. The UK had hoped that following Brexit, we would be able to procure a good trade deal with the US because of our special relationship, which I know we've just discussed. Is that still the case? But do you think that's likely following this announcement? Do you think we will get a good trade deal with the US?
Yes, I do. I think it's in the US's interest, and I think it's in the UK's interest. And I think we need to put the decision on tariffs on aluminium, not as the Americans will call it, aluminium. There is an I in it. And Steele, Donald Trump has made it perfectly clear that he prefers bilateralism. He likes one-on-one relationships. He's not a regionalist. He doesn't like multilateral organizations and having to negotiate in blocks. So the decision on steel and aluminium, again, these are political decisions primarily. Whatever we may think about some of the things that Donald Trump has said and done, if you have a look at what he said during his election period and on the hustings and in the campaigns, it may have got a bit masked by the rhetoric around it, but he's actually stuck to what he said he was going to do. And a lot of that was to focus on the interests of what he considers to be the forgotten Americans. Those communities in the United States that have kind of been left behind by globalization. And the target there for him were those states and those nations that he felt had abused the United States' position as the preeminent global economy for the last 30, 40, 50 years, and had sort of taken advantage of the US. In other words, they had strong trade deficits with the US. China is the obvious one that comes to mind. But in Europe, again, you look at Germany. Germany has a very, very strong trade balance with the United States. I'm not sure what the numbers are, but believe me, the US is big deficit with Germany. And so if President Trump wants to make a statement about an economy that he feels is not engaging in what he calls fair trade rather than free trade, then how is he going to do that? He can't do it against Germany alone. He has to do it against the EU generally. So I think we need to be a little bit wary of seeing this as a target, or the UK as a target. Is this impacting on those close ties that we have, be it a special or, if it's not a special relationship, it's still a very, very strong relationship. No, I don't think we should see this as a precursor or a harbinger of what's coming down the tracks for the UK-US with a free trade agreement. Our trade balance, US is actually one of the nations that we're in surplus with for trade and trading goods. But in services, it's the other way around. We're in deficit to the US. So if you balance it out, the Brit-American trade balance is pretty neutral. It's pretty flat. Therefore, in the eyes of Donald Trump and the administration, we are not a target. We are not one of those nations that he and they feel has not been fair to the United States. And so do I think then that the free trade agreement will move forward? Yes, I do. I think it's going to be a very difficult negotiation for the Brits. I think we're going to have to go into those discussions, and preambular discussions have already started, but we're going to have to go in with our eyes wide open. The US is a much, much bigger economy. It's seven times the size of our economy. And there are some cherished sectors in the UK that the Americans will be seeking. And one of those, and preeminent in that, will be agriculture and food and drink. And our negotiating team is going to have to go in, as I said, with their eyes wide open, knowing that the Americans are going to play hardball. They know they're going to be negotiating from a position of strength. The UK outside of the EU, no longer will we be able to treat that trade negotiation as equals. And so it's going to be tough. But is it in the US's interest? Yes, it is. Is it in the UK's interest? Absolutely. Preeminent, number one objective once the UK leaves the EU, if that comes about. It's going to have to be an FTA with the US. How long is it going to take? Historically, free trade agreements can take anything 5 to 7 years. This is not going to be quick, but hopefully a little bit quicker than that. So yes, it is a major objective for both sides. Yes, I do believe it will happen. But a note of caution, the Brits are going to have to give, and probably give quite a lot, to the Americans in the final analysis.
Thank you, Stephen. I know you've recently written a blog piece on this, Stephen, but on the world stage, what do you believe the future of UK diplomacy in a post-Brexit world will be?
Yeah, my favourite subject. I spent 30 years working in the Foreign Office. when I graduated university, it was my first career. I took a break in the middle of it, went into business as an entrepreneur, wanted to see whether I had made the right decision, sort of should I turn left after university or turn right. Although I was very entrepreneurial, I wasn't a great entrepreneur, so I obviously made the right decision. So 30 years in an organization, it gives you that ability to look beyond the shiny bits, the froth, and you get into the meat of the organization. And genuinely, I'm worried about what British foreign policy is going to look like after Brexit. For the last 40-odd years, we have been able to use our EU membership to basically secure a seat at the top table. I'm not sure that is going to happen once we are resigned to the ranks of being a medium power, a significant medium power. As I'm sitting in Birmingham, I would say we're more Aston Villa than we are Manchester City. And we're going to have to be realistic about that. But what has happened with the Foreign Office over the last 10 years, I would say, and there was the volcano of Brexit, but there were minor little earth tremors and earthquakes and tectonic movements over the last 10 years. And the agenda for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, the lead entity for Britain's international relations overseas, has changed. And its role in international trade was diluted. Its role in counterterrorism and security was diluted with the emergence of the National Security Council and a centralization within Number 10 and the Cabinet Office of that big ticket discussion. Aid and development was passed across to the Department for International Development. And then with Brexit, there was the formation of the Department for Exiting of Europe. You could legitimately say, well, what is Britain's foreign service, what does Britain's Foreign Office actually do now? They don't do immigration and passports. They don't do international trade. Increasingly, their role in counterterrorism, international security has been ceded to the Prime Minister's office and the Cabinet office. Ministry of Defence have taken full control of that international defence relationship, and international development is with DFID. That doesn't leave a great deal. So I worry about the erosion of the capability of Britain's frontline foreign engagement international liaison agency at a time when it's going to be absolutely pivotal that we get our relations with key partners right in the immediate aftermath of Brexit. So I've read a lot of the papers and I've seen a lot of the and heard a lot of the discussions and the interviews on global Britain and what will global Britain look like. Well, in order for global Britain to be able to punch above its weight as it's been doing for many, many decades, we are going to have a coordination of our governmental agencies that deal with this stuff. It was very interesting for me to see the Foreign Affairs Committee chair recently say basically the same thing, that the Foreign Office needs to be emboldened again post-Brexit. Now, as its name suggests, the Department for Exiting Europe means that once Britain exits Europe, there shouldn't be any need for that agency and or that ministry, that department, and therefore the role of engagement with European nations should return to the Foreign Office. So I think it's really important right now that government ministry, my old career anchor, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, does work to use its residual skill and talent in addressing the relationship with Europe and works on that now. What will our engagement strategy be post-Brexit with those big European nations that matter to us? Equally, what will it be with China and the United States and Russia once we're no longer in the European Union? And I think as an organization in the past, Britain has sort of clung to days of empire and clung to that sort of 20th century position where we were a global power and we had an entity, we had an embassy or a consulate or a high commission in just about every sovereign nation around the world. I don't think we're going to be able to do that anymore. I think global Britain means that we should have global influence, but we should have strategic locations. And there will be parts of the world where we just will not be able to be as well-staffed, well-equipped. And we're just going to have to face the facts that our relations with perhaps some of the smaller African nations, some of the Central American nations, some of those smaller island states out in the Pacific and in the Far East, we're going to have to either cover those from elsewhere, so use a sort of hub and spoke type approach, or we embrace modern technology and we look at virtual embassies, we look at virtual entities around the world that will allow us to have a global reach but not a global presence. And I think it's going to be very, very important that we look at other medium-sized powers around the world who have concentrated their interests in areas that really, really matter to them. And for us, that has to be Europe. It has to be our existing relationships out in Asia. I think it remains in core parts of the Middle East, in Africa, and of course with America, Canada, Mexico, and some of the larger South American nations. So I think it's going to be a very, very important time for British foreign policy. I think it's really, really important that the Foreign Office, as that agency of government to deliver on this, is equipped, empowered, and perhaps we look at a re-centralisation of international development, of international trade, bringing it back under one fold so you have a conjoined and concerted overseas approach to issues that are going to really, really matter for us within the next 10 years.
Thank you, Stephen. Well, that's all we've got time for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Professor Stephen Bridges, for his time. Your contribution to today's podcast has been extremely informative in providing more information on global Britain and foreign policy. If you found this podcast interesting and would like more information from the Centre, please visit our website at www.bcu.ac.uk/centre-for-brexit-studies, where you'll also find details on how to sign up to our monthly newsletter. Bye for now.